right, welcome back again. And today we're talking, this is kind of part two on our gender slash, maybe gender roles. So this isn't as about gender identity today as much as it's about, well, it can be about whatever you want, but ultimately it's designed to start with the idea of religion in general, criticism, Judaism specifically, Islam as well, have frequently been accused of saying women are valued less fully than men, differently than men, are given a different or subservient role. I think the famous verse that everybody loves to quote when talking in an attack version against Christianity is, "Wives, be submissive to your husbands as unto the Lord." And there are many, many a counseling story. I'm sure if you talk to Mr. Goodnight, he could probably tell you of when the husband, the argument's going on, he's like, "You're supposed to submit to me like you are to God." You know, it usually doesn't go over well in the argument. It's, I think it's 0 for 10,000 on success rate, quoting it in the middle of an argument or a heated battle. So the real question today, in my mind, is to make sure that you're thinking about this properly, I'm actually really glad that Asher and Effie are here as well, because they will be both visual and hopefully, if one of y'all wants to come up and sit up top too, I would love for you to field questions, because you actually have a tougher one to defend, maybe, than Christianity, which seems, at least here in Reston, we've melded with culture enough that we are less likely to draw ire than someone in the Jewish community, where the roles have remained maybe more stable over time in such a way that they have, quote-unquote, more to defend sometimes. Or at least I know it can probably feel like that for you guys, right? So what I would like you to remember as you're asking this, as we're asking questions today, is you ought not ask the questions, in my opinion, solely from a 21st century American viewpoint. The question is, what has Christianity and Judaism, what have they said over all of time? And how much of what we expect about gender is a product of our culture? And just as a brief reminder to some of the, because we've talked about this kind of stuff a little bit previously in class, to those who are in class now, you know, we often think, the way that we think of gender roles today is exactly the way that it's been in America forever. And that's not the case. If you remember the Rosie the Riveter, nice save, by the way. If you remember the Rosie the Riveter posters, that was a big change in the way that women were viewed. Women were not people who worked in an industry. Women were not people, the idea of roles, you don't see a woman mechanic prior to World War II. But out of necessity, a lot of the guys are gone. Who's going to build planes and cars and fly them and transport them and all that kind of stuff? And it's the ladies that ended up doing that. So it took a propaganda effort to shape American cultural mentality enough to say, not only is this right, it's patriotic. Not only is it okay, it's a moral obligation, almost. So remember that changes, and even, I love to point to art. Ladies, if you ever feel bad about yourself because this culture is telling you need to be a size 2, and you have to have this kind of makeup, and you have to have this kind of hair, and all that other type of stuff, go back and look at the ladies from the Baroque period, and you're going to feel very good about your weight, or you may feel like, man, I'm too skinny, it's time to put on a little weight. I saw somebody put on our Facebook page recently, I'm not sure why this is the Solid Ground Facebook page, but Alyssa Milano talking about her weight and, you know, saying something along the lines of, you know, mothers were not, you can't be a super skinny mama and provide what you need for the baby, basically. It was roughly what she was saying of women, and she said it in a way that I think might be offensive to some people, but one of the purposes of women is to have children, and if that's the case, then you can't be insanely skinny and have children. She said it differently, but the idea is it's even floating around in our culture today. So as we're asking these questions, try to take yourself, do answer the questions within our culture, but think all the way back to culturally, broadly across the globe. Just because we do it a certain way here doesn't mean it's done a certain way in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia, in Eurasia, in Africa, and South America. So keep all that in mind as you're asking your question, because if you don't, I'll bring it back up. All right. Are men and women equal?
Yes.
Now we're going to close.
Okay. We have two opposite sides here. So what do we mean by equal?
When you say equal, or are they treated equal?
Are they?
Of course they're equal.
Equal. Okay. So of course.
What do you mean by equal? That males and females are equal in all respects.
In all respects?
So I'll bring up two.
What about in like average height?
Yeah.
Yeah, even physically, no, they're not. Okay. I was talking about their.
I mean, even emotionally and mentally, there are like neurological differences between males and females. I think females have closer to 15 place areas in the brain that register body language, and that's why women are better at reading body language cues, but men have like 3 or 4. So just mental. That's also not true.
I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
It's the only really steady one I can
hold on to. But otherwise, what kind of value? Because you can put a value on somebody as an athlete, somebody as a thinker, or the ways that they can think.
Spiritual and emotional value.
Spiritual and emotional. So we'll, what's the difference between those?
I think, well, emotions are humanly generated, while the spirit is something that's aside from your human aspect of the flesh. So I think spiritually the Lord will look upon both genders as his children equally and lovingly.
Okay.
And emotionally we still have value in a similar playing field.
Do you think God makes a gender distinction?
I mean, is God a woman or a man? Let's ask this question.
Well, I think God's all humans.
Yeah, so I don't think he would make a distinction because I don't think he doesn't have bias. He's not human. He wouldn't be weak enough to make a bias based on gender.
Right. Well, he should have been treating you very well after the eighth apple.
Okay. I guess, can I say this, does God hate women? Or does he see them?
Wait, hold on. Who said does God hate women?
I'm
going to say that.
I'm putting a little bit of fire in this.
Can I answer that real quick? I link to the woman study that was done by Ruffner. And in the Bible, in the very beginning, when God says helper, that's not the word he uses. He uses Acer. And Acer doesn't have any technical translation in the English language, but it's used to describe very few people, including Jesus, and it means kind of running at a great pace to someone who desperately needed help. And he did not give that term to Adam, he gave it to Eve. He gave Acer to Eve and Acer to his son Jesus. So I think God would typically hate woman if he gave such like a prestigious title to her.
And that's good, but there's no way I'm not going to my Hebrew scholars in the back to
I'm not
to
a Hebrew scholar, so don't send me on this, please.
Well, whilst they do some research on that one, we'll let them re-engage when they're ready.
What about Lilith?
What about love? Well, let's hit the core issue. Great question, but you know, an hour long time frame. Okay. When we say
first wife, I think.
When we say, which by the way appears in Lewis, if you read the Chronicles of Narnia.
That was in the History Channel once.
What was it? Who remembers the book in which this was? It was one of the persons is talking to one of the humans in the. From Narnia. Oh, this may be the Line of the Witch and the Wardrobe.
Yes.
And says it's she the White Witch is a descendant of Adam's first wife, Lilith. So Lewis makes a reference to that, which is an interesting thing. It's not exactly orthodoxy in Christianity. Okay. When we say are men and women equal, we mean it many ways. So like always, definitions are important, and make sure that you're not what's the word that means you're thinking too definitions, but it's one word. Equivocation. So the fallacy of equivocation is going to wreck you when it comes to gender stuff every single time. So when you make a statement of, are men and women equal? That is not a question. That is a match. That is a blasting cap. That is the addition of a catalyst to an otherwise calm chemical reaction that's about to go exothermic. So you have to say exactly what you mean. Are men and women morally equivalent? Are men and women's lives of equal value to humans? Are men and women equal in God's eyes? No. So really, the first question you want to ask is, are they morally equivalent? I think. So are men and women morally equal? Is the life of a woman equal to the life of a man in value of life?
No, so I don't know how we could answer that.
Say that again.
In many places, no.
And where, we could where, say yes because it makes us comfortable. That's why we practice here. But.
And where is that? Where might that be the case?
A lot of very old countries.
Okay, well, in Asia, right, as an example, yeah. In China, it had been practice of if you have a daughter and you don't want a daughter, you go put her on the mountain and she dies.
Yeah.
Although that's not as widespread as it always is.
Now they have more men than women.
Yes, ma'am.
In Old Testament somewhere, I don't recall exactly, either David or Solomon said, out of 1,000 men, he can find one righteous. None from any woman. Something like that. So
yes.
How does it fit?
Now, so that, right now, this is a separate question that we will also get into, but you're right. That's a good one to parse out. When I say morally equivalent, what I don't mean is, are they equally likely to do the right thing?
Right, because it brings up a responsibility to the time.
The question might be something like this, and this is a completely ridiculous scenario, but. If you had to shoot somebody, a man or a woman, and you were going to choose which one was of lower value, which one would you shoot? Now, of course, the question is ridiculous, but the idea is, do you value one person just based on gender alone as more valuable than another? That's the question.
Speaking purely from a societal cultural perspective, right, not setting any biblical precedent here, but I mean, in the classic tradition, if the ship is going down, right, the women and children get on the lifeboats first. So there is, at least culturally, some basis to say that the life of a woman is more valuable than the life of a man.
Okay,
that's just a macho thing.
So let's say that's derivative of chivalry, or some sort of chivalric. It's not, but let's say that it is. So one is this is a cultural norm in the West, and there's a cultural norm in the East that maybe is in portions of the West and portions of the East that are at odds. And then there's other places where you can make the argument the other way, too. Example, in Norway, back in the times of the Viking funerals, does anybody know what the original Viking funeral was?
The with the suburban town?
Yeah, so that's like the more modern romanticized version of it. I won't describe it, but it's horrific.
The wives had to die, the children had to die, the livestock had to die, and they were all buried with the husband.
At a minimum, the wife was killed, too. You put her on the boat and she light up, or sometimes they killed her ahead of time and put her on the boat for everyone else.
I think it's actually really important that you've split this question into two. Are women and men morally equivalent to other human beings or to God? Because to human beings, there is really no consistent thread through time.
Okay.
I mean, sometimes it's, well, they're of more value, put them in the lifeboat first. Sometimes it's, go put your baby daughter on a mountain. I mean, completely across the board, different. And to God, there's at least a consistent thread there.
With God, there's a consistent.
You have to separate history and documentation of history in the Bible.
You tell me
the actual Word of God Scripture.
And you hope that the Word of God Scripture is consistent.
And I think it is. Challenge
exactly. Go ahead. Dennis is such a frequent contributor. He's often pleased to allow us to skip him.
What do you mean by moral value? Because you could, at any given time, express that men are more valuable because we're in the middle of a war, we might fight. Other times, women are more valuable because there's less of them, or if you want to expand the population, you might rely more on women to do that. But when you say morally, I'm not quite sure what you're trying to express.
All right, good. So we have gotten this question and this question and this side comment get to the core issue, which is, if you're going to ask the question, is one or the other of greater moral value, what is the assumption? There is an underlying unstated assumption. What's the unstated premise?
I mean, I'm not really going to answer your question, but we've only recently, it's like a Western civilization, come to the conclusion that we're equal, because back in medieval times it was like, oh, women are these like morally deplorable beings, and like they will seduce you in like a snap of fingers. And then once modernism and the Victorian period came around, it's like, oh, men are the worst ones because they have all these like desires and they can't check and everything. And, like, women are these like perfect angels that you're not supposed to.
And this is good. This is tracing that judgment of whether some of moral excellence by dint of gender over time, to see that even in the same in Western society it has gone through that one. But back to this, yes, sir. I did skip you. Go ahead.
Women are still not treated right in this country.
Agreed.
Even today.
Agreed. In fact, you can argue.
It took until 1927 before you could vote.
Well, this is probably a risky statement to make, but if I were a lady, I would rather be a lady prior to 1920 than post 1990. because of the way that at least the culture looks at me and judges me.
If I was a lady and I was your size, I'd be kicking ass.
Yes,
ma'am.
So
I
guess
swear,
the,
it's
the
disgusting.
Question, how morality is, because I look at an individual and I
want to
see what they're capable of doing, and I don't this woman does good work, she keeps her virtues, and then another woman doesn't, and then this man, and so forth. So you have an individual case. So I guess I don't understand why.
Why is it got to be split by gender? And so it is important to say that I'm trying not to, what I don't mean by the question is, who's more likely to do the right thing? What I mean to say is, if I'm going to ask the question, is one of greater moral value, what does it presuppose, obviously? That there are morals and a moral value, and that there is a grounding for that moral value. Because if it's subjective, then when the culture says women are more value, then they are ipso facto of more value. And if the culture changes its mind, then the value has changed because it's not objective. So this question presupposes objective values. What's the source for objective values? God. So if you don't have a God, or you don't have a grounding like God for moral values, then your moral values are not objective. And if you want to say, is the life of a man worth more than the life of a woman? That's really what I mean by the question. Not who's going to be better, but is her life worth more than his life because she's female and he's male? Or the other way around, is his life somehow worth more than her life because he's male and she's female? I think the reason I'm asking the question is nobody in the class... I won't even ask you to raise your hand. I will say it. Nobody in the class believes that a man is more worth more than a woman in this kind of value I'm talking about. But what you have to ask the question of is, why is that the case? You believe it intuitively, but you haven't gotten that from your culture. Because like Aaron said, that changes over time. That changes over time. And even in today's culture, I mean, you can maybe argue for either way, but I think you can argue in today's culture what was sung in the song back in the day of, it's a man's world a little bit. So even though we don't act like it, sometimes it seems like we value men, or even though we may not say it politically, it seems like we value men in today's culture more than we do women. In my opinion, that's this culture is still male dominated.
Men value men more than, it's not we, men value men more than they value women.
That may be the case, but I want you to know how much further below, how much lower my value for you is than for my wife. And it is a great distance. Nah, I'm just joking. You're right. Your point is correct.
You're talking specifics. Men pretty much have ruled the world since we got to either buy your way or my way. They were physically strong, and they just ruled.
Yeah, and that's ultimately, when you go to those other cultures where we like to say, being quote-unquote civilized, and less civilized cultures, that, I mean, men will beat the women. This was in Afghanistan. I asked an interpreter. I want to make the point, and we'll come back to the rest of it because you made too many
20-minute points.
You made too many great points. I can't. This guy, all the interpreters want to come to the United States. They're always looking for a visa. This one guy who was our most Americanized interpreter, black baseball cap, black Harley jacket with patches on it, talks like an American, short shaved beard. You would have thought that we brought him from America, put him in Afghanistan, because he even talked, he learned English from the local special forces team. So I can't quote you anything that he says because it's laced with expletives. But he was as Americanized as it gets. And we were like, hey, man, do you want to come to the States? And he's like, no. We're like, well, do you want to try to get a visa? He's like, no. We're like, why? And he goes, well, I value freedom too much. And, of course, we're all like, America is freedom, punk. What are you talking about? And he says, well, he goes, look, you know, I love my wife. She's actually the most beautiful lady in the village or whatever, just his value system, and arguably ours sometimes. And he says, but look, you know, she kind of gets out of her place, and I have to put her back in her place. I got to smack her or something like that. I can do that here, and it'll all work out okay. But if I do that in America, I'm going to get put in jail. And he goes, this guy over here, if he insults my family and tries to kill somebody, I'm going to take my AK and I'm going to shoot him. And it actually works out here, but in America, they're going to throw me in jail. He's right. He does have more freedom than in Afghanistan. And the question is, do you want to live in that society that way?
Certainly less culpability.
Certainly less culpability, but the idea and accountability. But the idea is, there, where might makes right, The man will be more valued than the woman because he looks more powerful, his will is enforced, and all those kinds of things. The question is, is that the way things ought to be? Now, we all here say, no, that's not the way things ought to be. Well, now, do we say, no, that's the way things ought to be? for good moral reasons and good philosophical reasons, or do we say it because we're Americans in 21st century America? Yes, ma'am.
Well, here's the thing. That society, only maybe the men have more freedom, the men here, but only the men have more freedom. So, whereas in this society, everyone has to give up more freedoms so that everyone can be more free.
Yes, I see your point. Yeah, that makes some sense. But does, how does it speak to the question? Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No.
Dennis, I forgot to let you finish.
Everything about our society, religions, all religions, God is man. The worst person is he. Jesus is a he. Most religions are man-made. I think they're man-made, and the top guy is always a guy. So Sistine Chapel is an old man touching fingers with a young man.
Right.
And that kind of society is naturally going to put women not quite up to the top.
And
it's always been, and it still is that.
And it is the case. So a minor nitpicky correction. The Bible says specifically God is not a man. He says things like that he may lie. But man, he doesn't mean male. He means like
an individual.
He's a human being.
He's always shown as a man.
But he is referred to with the male pronoun all the way through the Bible. And the question is, what does that mean? Now, that's really a subsequent question, because unless we have linked this and this and this, we're asking the question out of order.
So throughout all of the value judgments and how women, per se, have gone through an evolutionary process, you know, from the history that we know about, where we have God as a religion, we also have government. So if we think about, like, the past 50 years that I can recollect, how the government has actually been more responsible for providing women opportunities and more choices to the detriment of God.
All right, this and Peter, go ahead.
They're always
to Dennis's thing. I've wondered that too. But I think God referring to himself as a he, and the Holy Spirit as he. Like when I think John changes around the Greek, like violates Greek grammar to refer to the Holy Spirit as a he.
Right.
But I think it's to show that he's a person. I think it's more of a functional he. You know, like God functioning as.
And we'll get to that, but hold on to that point until later in the class, because okay, we're going to need that one later. This resonates with everybody, right? Why is America one of the greatest nations ever? Opportunity. We give people choices, whatever. And women, too. They have more opportunity and choice now than they ever have before. Why is this important to us? What is this reduced to?
Freedom.
Okay, and so freedom is, I would argue, really one of the base as in most foundational values out there. So the reason, why is it that it is morally offensive to us to hear that the woman in Afghanistan can't leave her compound without a male escort? Why is that? Seems to violate her freedom. Why is it now? Is it good for protection? Of course it's good. It's good security practice. But somehow it also feels like it's a lack of freedom. If in an argument, the man can use this to dominate her, she has lost freedom because she's not free to say everything that she means to. So really, freedom appears to be a very important thing. Now, why is freedom a very important thing? Back to something I harp on all the time. What do you have to have this for?
Free will.
Why do you have to have free will in order to have love? So if love is the greatest ethic of all time, you have to have equal freedom for both parties in order for love to work. So that's actually the reason that we want, so I'm going to shortcut it a little bit because we've gotten there. The reason that we think that there ought to be a moral equivalence between men and women is because we value love and we think love is the most important thing. And if you're not free to love, then you're not free. And if you're not free, that's wrong. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to make a point about the government that you made. This government only gave women the right to vote some 70 years after they freed slaves.
Right.
So we don't have exactly a great record when it comes to.
Yeah, and this isn't, I mean, you know, I'm Mr. Yay America, but this isn't a pro-America class, so, I mean, your point is taken. Sorry, yes, a bit here and then that.
Okay, so just back to free will for a moment. I feel that free will is something that you can't deny, like your gender identification.
Good point. So maybe not the possession of free will, but the ability to exercise that freedom.
Yes, because we always, each one of us has the capability, especially Dennis, to come up and say the things, just don't have to be that.
Right.
And we need that.
Right. But, and, you know, when we're talking about this, the question is, you know, the husband says, this is what we're going to do with the children, and the wife says no, and then he hits her. This is what we're going to do with the children, the wife says no, and then he hits her. So if that's the case, at some point, we're going to say her freedom is curbed, because even though her soul, her mind, her most inward portion will say, I still don't want to do that, that's wrong, she may end up saying, yes, dear, when she, in fact, means exactly the opposite. Matt and Lynn.
Doesn't the concept, when you introduce love, kind of automatically obviate the whole discussion in the fact that you're talking about two parties? Or, you know, love can't be a one-party thing, so therefore you have to have two parties. And that gets back to the interesting point about the ezer, or the compatibility of, you know, what it is to be the imperfect harmony. And I think that from what I know about ezer, and I'd like to hear the Hebrew definition of it, is that it's an actual completion that you can't do yourself. It's something that says it's outside of what I have, and, you know, blends perfectly with the compatibilist nature of what it, God's purpose.
It takes two to make a thing go right. It takes two to make it out of system.
And only.
Do we have any commentary from the experts in the back? Not at this point. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
I was going to say, maybe we could throw in there the Delta definition, the parameters that are not violating somebody else. We're talking about freedom, we're talking about, well, he's free to hit her, he's free to, you know, and it's like, well, if we want to further define it, we should say love, and you guys can help me out with the words, but without violating somebody else's value or human value.
Well, we used to call it space or personal parameters or well, even our own free will.
Yeah, I mean, more intentionally, like just, not just space, but, you know, even violating somebody's value, you can do that without, you know, touching them or whatever.
Right.
But
right.
Like the Afghan man feels that if he is not protecting his wife, he's not doing his job. Mm-hmm. Right?
But
so that's
that. Her
he doesn't believe that.
Right. Now, and let's take it out of Afghanistan and put it back in our own cultural milieu. If you go back to medieval times, was there any question, not the restaurant, which is terrible, but the actual factory? If you go back to this time, what was the knight's duty? What was his sworn duty? To protect with his wife's blood, this lady love kind of thing. So this courtly love idea that grew out of a little bit more brutal versions that happened before was something saying, physically, no one doubts the knight's superiority. But it is his job and responsibility to place her on a pedestal to defend her with his very life.
That's the capacities of God's goodness.
Right. And so the question is this, if you ask the knight who's more valuable, he won't actually tell you the lady's more valuable. He'll say, my life is worth her life. My life I will lay down for her. That doesn't automatically mean that she is of greater value. What it means is, and this is where we're getting into it, this was a, back even in the days of physical dominance was still the way things could work. This was role setting. The role of the woman is not to fight, the role of the man is to fight. Why? Because they're bigger and stronger and faster. They carry more armor and they do more damage. But values. They are inverting the value based on physical. Now, this also works. The same actually goes in Afghanistan in some ways, too. Go into a guy's house in Afghanistan and try to even look at his wife. You will get shot in the face. Okay? Because he is going to protect his wife in the way that makes cultural sense to him.
Yes,
the look of skepticism is deepened to the point that you're
the knife thing is a little bit difficult because in a lot of those scenarios, there's a monarchy that is ordained by God that gets into
very oversimplified. So very oversimplified. Let's focus on one little part.
That's, yeah, well, monarchy and government are not exactly overlapping.
No, they don't.
But yeah. And it was only high-born women.
There you go.
That were
so that was the difference between a lady and a woman. But the same is also true between a knight and a peasant. A peasant was, or a non-freeman, his life, you could take any time you wanted to.
I think if you're forgetting, though, in this whole protection thing, it's not just about the man. It's not just about the man protecting the woman for the woman's sake. The woman is his property.
Yeah.
Just like you would protect, you know, a valuable car that you might own.
Okay.
You would, you know, get the best insurance on that, make sure it's locked away in a garage. You know, that's how women are. And it's not that they are valuable for their own sake.
All right, give me a second. Let's run down this rabbit hole.
Are
so why?
Because they make the man look good.
Why is it wrong to treat a woman like property?
That's the best comment I've made here.
I know. We're falling down to its...
we don't have class once a week, then.
Why is it wrong to treat a woman as a problem?
Because that's basically conveying a sense of ownership. And rather than her individuality... Exactly.
Is ownership wrong?
I mean, that's slavery, isn't it?
Okay, so why is slavery wrong?
Tell me.
No, I'm not saying, I'm not suggesting that they are. I'm asking
just asking questions here.
It takes away free will, it takes away choice, and if you are owning a woman, that takes away love.
So the reason that this offends us is it impinges on freedom, and the reason impinging on freedom offends us is because it's not in keeping with this ethic. And we see this, shotgun weddings, forced arranged marriages against the will of the bride or sometimes groom. Honor killings, all this kind of stuff. This impinges on love, and that's why we think that it's wrong. Rachel, and then Guy, and then Peter.
When Aaron was running through the historics, this sounds really nerdy, but I'm going to do a major in Norse mythology. But anyway, going in old Nordic history, woman... There were free women, there were free men, there were unfree men, there were unfree women. And the unfree had the opportunity in warfare to fight for their freedom. If you were a free woman and someone raped you or anyone tried to infringe on your rights, you could legally either someone else, you could hire someone to kill them, or you could kill them yourself without any kind of detriment to yourself. Women were completely and 100% free. But it goes back to the warfare thought. But the thing is, technically, women could be earls, women could own land. If you were an earl and a woman and you had an unfree man under you, they were technically your slave. So I think in history, I think it's very cultural, and we can't just be like, oh, this is the neo-European classical view of how they went through history, because, I mean...
Yeah, but that's a political hierarchy.
That's true, though. So we'll say, but we've acknowledged this point. The point is this. The respective value has varied through culture, not only geographically, but within the culture itself, generally speaking. So now, let's say we got that point, we acknowledge it, we're past that. The question now is it wrong, and if so, why? So that's what we're answering here is, tell me if I'm wrong, but the answer to your question of why slavery is wrong is, how do you love a slave?
Yeah, and how does the slave love you?
How does the slave love you? Now, can that be done?
Sure, some cases.
As Thomas Jefferson.
Right. I don't mean in the prurient sense, but can you have actual love for a slave? In fact, the Bible has a portion of it where again, it's more like indentured servitude. I know people are tired of hearing that, but ultimately, if a slave loves his master and upon the giving of his freedom does not want to be set free, the master must take him to the doorpost and take an awl and punches through his ear into the doorpost and then ostensibly lets him go after that. But the idea is, some people may say, I wish to serve and be a servant to this master, and they do this in love. And the master loves the servant, and the servant loves the master. So the reason I bring that one up is, and I see you nodding, to at least suggest that, well, it's possible that it makes sense. What's the difference? How is if freedom is antithetical to love, and some person has submitted themselves to be a slave to another master, how is love possible if freedom is antithetical to love?
It's not slavery.
Why?
It's not slavery because it's a choice. If I choose to place myself in a relationship, in that kind of relationship, and then it goes south.
Yes.
And that person, hey, you made this choice. You're my... Now we're back to slavery.
Okay.
If I have the option, I'm going to be in your service.
Yes, mutually beneficial.
Whatever. If I'm going to be in your service and I lose the ability to leave, then it's slavery.
It's slavery.
Yes.
It's, you would say that by that definition, it's slavery. Stand by for ambush.
Yes.
Captain, stand by for ambush.
Yeah.
I'm done with the Air Force. I've had enough with you guys. I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. I'm leaving the base.
AWOL.
No, you're not.
Yeah.
You're AWOL. We're throwing you back in jail. You've lost your freedom. Are all military members slaves?
All
except for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of
Staff. All military members have signed a contract with the force.
Yeah, but it goes south. I don't like the way it works.
I didn't enter into my contract with the Air Force out of love.
But we weren't saying one has to enter the contract out of love in order for it not to be slavery. The statement you made was, if you can voluntarily enter a subservient, superior relationship, a slave-master relationship, a you-tell-me-what-to-do-and-I-obey-it relationship, and then you decide to change your mind later, the second you decide to change your mind and no longer willingly submit to that authority, it now becomes slavery. If that's the case, when I...
You don't see any distinction between historical American slavery and the modern U.S. military. You don't see those distinctions.
I am a Marine who has bailed and too many Marines out of jail and put too many Marines in jail to suggest that there isn't an awful lot of similarity between the two. Now, is that the difference between you can drag this slave off and kill him? Well, in World War II, when the Marines didn't do what we wanted to do.
I read those chapters out of DC&J all the time to people. You fell asleep on post. I know it comes out on the desk.
Right.
Read this to me.
This is what we used to do.
What can I do to you?
I can shoot you in the face.
I can shoot you in the face right here.
the infantryman who's now a lawyer would say,
"Right, I'm not supposed to be right."
Okay, yes, sir. Peter, I'm sorry. Let me do Peter first, and then you get up and skip Peter for a while.
I think about the ownership of people. I think officially we don't really own people, but in our thoughts, in our thinking, in our language, and in our actions, we do those things as though we do own, like, that's my wife, or that's my husband, that's my man, that's my woman, you know, or this is my kid, you know, the kid doesn't even make the choice to be owned by you, but if you don't take ownership of a kid, then what, that's himself.
And being the parent of a 3-month-old now, I can say sometimes a mom's like, I'm not sure about this, can I sign up for this one? This is more like a slave right now, right?
Yeah, but it's like if someone takes it, say, hey, he's mine. Right. You can't take him. You know, that's he's mine.
Okay.
And so,
no, Jimmy, he's still selling it in the United States.
What? That's ridiculous.
So you can sell one?
Yes.
Well, then that's another.
He's not a Craigslist.
So it seems like thinking and actions.
Yeah, this is a good point. The point that we're really asking about here is, you know, we made it sound like ownership, that's automatically bad. And then we say, but wait a minute, we express ownership sometimes as the language of love. Also, people who are in owner-slave relationships can demonstrate love by being voluntary. And although one doesn't enter the Air Force and Marine Corps for love, it seems like restrictions on freedom don't automatically equal slavery, unless we're willing to say we're slaves. But I'm drawing the distinction just to say the definition has to be carefully parsed. So if this is the case, let me ask the question from where I was going to end up quoting The Matrix at least once in a given class. What if that's the case? I mean, do you are you guys are Americans? Are you truly free? Are you completely free?
No.
You know, like, how do you answer the Afghan of, I'm free because I can shoot this guy or slap my wife? You know, you can kind of make that point.
So I was just going off what you were saying. My thought is, if we're defining freedom as love, who's to say that the Afghan who beats his wife doesn't think that he's loving his wife? If society is embracing of, you know, there's also misplaced love where you are hurting someone because you're so afraid that they'll hurt themselves, so you beat them. And then in their society, you're honored for being a strong husband, which may include being your wife, so you can adapt that, well, you are a part of me, and just because I'm doing this, I'm kind of honoring you by bringing you into my home. Who's to say he doesn't?
Lest you think that doesn't sound right, consider this. Why do you hit your children, for those of you that spank your children?
Because they deserve it.
And that's the only reason.
You do it, because you would say this. I love my child, that's why I disagree.
Yeah.
Okay, now the worst version of this is, so you at least buy into that enough that most, I would say probably, I imagine most people in here respect their children. The downside of this is what? He hits me because he loves me. You hear that from abused spouses too, right? So, this is, let me ask the Matrix question, or make the Matrix statement now. The Merovingian says to Morpheus and Trinity and Neo when they're there, and the second one, choice is an illusion created between those who have power and those who have not. And the idea is the freest person is the one who enjoys the most power. That's the implication of that statement. Is that true? Is choice an illusion created between those with power and without? Or is that is to say, the more powerful you are you more free?
I'd like to bring this up. I had a friend.
Does it impact his point?
Yes, it does. It is his part of his point. And I've been like thinking about this and like the whole the slavery and the ownership. I have a friend who was college date raped. But the guy said she was asking for it. Like, he was like, oh, I love you. And this is why I did it. Like, this is my way of showing love to you. He was like, but you were asking for it. Like, what you were. Yeah, that was awful. But if, hypothetically, the man in Afghanistan can hit his wife because he's showing love, can't some fraternity boy drug a girl's drink and then rape her because that's his way of showing love? If you're gonna, you can't twist love. Love doesn't have fear. Love has boundaries. Love has limits.
So that you can do anything you want in the name of love. But the real question is it loving? Which is part of the point that you brought up earlier. You can't say I love her, therefore I do this to her, or I love him, therefore I do this to him. Love is a selfless and benevolent. So if what you're doing is not selfless and is not benevolent, is that correct? Via Holland?
T.
No.
If it's not benevolent, now here's a 60, and this is what it boils down to, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to know what the answer is to all of these points, it's this. So selfless, we get, right? You got to be doing it for their reason. But even when you supposedly, if you spank your kids, even though you're not doing it for your own selfish reasons, the idea is you're doing that selflessly. Like, you don't even want to do it, but you're doing it because if it's not spanking, it's doing disciplining your kids, you're doing it for them. What's the problem with benevolent? Who gets to set what is good? Benevolent means valence, kind of where I'm going with it. Valence, power. Good. Power for good. Or the things that are good. So if you want things that are good for somebody else, who defines the good? Now, the Afghan may say, well, what's good is for her to be safe. The abusive boyfriend may be, she doesn't see it. Here's your creepy stalker version of this one. She doesn't see that I'm the right guy for her. But if I can make her see, I will be the best man for her for the rest of her life.
Especially if she's in a drug.
Right? They may. Well, that's the idea. Is if I hook or crook, if the idea is that he's at. If it is true, this is a big if that nobody believes, but if it is true that he's actually the best guy for her, do the ends justify the means?
No.
Why not?
He had to be subversive to do it or subterfuge or some such.
And it certainly is not benevolent.
Yeah. Why is it certainly not benevolent?
Well, benevolence, as we think about what benevolence is a kind, good, gracious thing. It's tied to selflessness, sure.
Spanking is not kind and good and gracious. Locking your kid in a timeout is not kind and good and gracious, at least on its own.
Well,
appearance.
I would say that it is, in a sense, because if your child does not know the discipline of consequences and actions, then they could definitely go up a wrong stream. But we don't want to.
Short term pain, long term gain? Mm-hmm. Short-term pain of being drugged and date-raped, long-term pain of being with the guy that's the best for her in the world.
Then I have to make
and justify the means by this argument. The reason it does, and I'm not saying that's the case, right? The reason you're right is because of this. This man has decided this stalker and rapist has decided he's a measure of them. He doesn't know he's the best man for her. And any man that would treat, and this is what we all know, any man that would do that to a woman can't possibly be the best one for her, right?
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't she know somehow?
I feel like we've been chasing our tails this whole time, and you're getting at that, but I'm going to go out and say it. If we continue to dwell on the value statements of other cultures that we're not going to agree with,
right,
even in this room we don't agree with each other, it's just chasing our tails. It's not going to get us anywhere. We have to speak to what does God say about it.
So we
and
say,
I think even Dennis would agree with that, because, I mean, it's a short class. And if we don't discuss what God says about women and men and their roles, then it's going to be
as a basis for understanding, right?
It's kind of worthless. It's just divisive and random.
That's right. You had a comment, I skipped you.
while ago.
I kind of agree with what she said about the value, because I think we need to make a distinction between extrinsic value and intrinsic value, the ones that God imputes within us to remain in his image, which is, intrinsically we're valuable to God. But then
we're getting there, but hold on to that point for 1 second, because Dennis is sitting in the front. Yeah, but Dennis is sitting in the front row, and he by dint of his belief system, when you say it's the value God sets on them, it is naturally going to say, what does that mean to me? Nothing. It's noise and
it's annoying.
Right. So the yes, sir.
I was going to say her point is still the best one I've heard about property, women being property.
Right.
Which one of your commandments is thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's ox?
Number eight.
Eight.
Eight or nine.
Well, that's a man's...
Come on, guys. eight or nine.
Whatever, that's a man's commandment.
Right.
It doesn't say women should not covet the neighbor's husband or whatever. The other thing is, there's no commandment against rape.
Is there any commandment against rape?
Do you want to know this?
Yes.
There are many commandments against rape.
It's not a commandment.
Be fair.
It's not a command. There's no law against rape. That's completely wrong.
There's no commandment. One of the Ten Commandments doesn't say rape.
It's not one of the Ten Commandments. So that's like saying there's no commandment against being homosexual. That's no commandment against. All right.
Wait, I got one.
Go ahead.
I'm 77. I've lived a long time. To now, it's finally dawned on me why any of you girls would ever marry a guy is beyond. Why any woman today would marry a man is beyond me.
That may be the case, I believe.
I got a reason. You say men have power, they have physical power.
Yes, they have some kinds of power.
Today, women have got the power. They just don't know what it is.
Okay, and are you going to tell us what the mystery is, or are you going to tell them because you and I have talked about it?
I'll let you stew one.
Okay. don't hold your breath.
She's definitely more powerful than her agent.
Okay, so. Let's take this point at face value and say this. It will be impossible to come to any agreement on value until you have an agreed-upon value system. Easy, right? Everybody, whether they culturally irrelevant, name me the culture that says this is not the highest ethic. What culture is that?
Scientology.
Scientology still says it's the highest ethic.
I don't know what it is.
There is no culture of which I'm aware on this planet that when you interview the person over time and you get past the, I've been told this and whatever, and you say, what do you think? Is there anything higher than this?
Right, everybody says,
I mean, you have points of time like Japan, pre-World War II, or during World War II, where the devotion was to a hero, and the common good of the people was meant to serve them. Arguably North Korea would fall in that category. Although I'm sure if you actually interview people,
and that's what I mean, is get past the, as the emperor commands, so we must do. Or in Sparta,
But if you're really talking about beyond what someone would testify to and how they're really living their lives, I think there's obviously been examples throughout time where there's been a devotion to something other than love.
When it comes to how we live our lives, I will tell you that in my humble opinion, 99% of the population live like they don't think this is true. The interesting thing is, though, when you sit them down and you do that interview thing, I think you acknowledge the point of, yeah, ultimately they'll say, I can think of no higher ethic than this. Even the guy in North Korea, even the Kims would say, there's no higher ethic than love. Now, well, are they acting in accordance with that? No.
Well, they are. They're loving themselves.
Well, yes, but the love of somebody else, they would say that's the right thing. They will couch what they say as, this is love for the people. I'm doing the best thing that I can for my people.
And we know it's deceptive.
Not only in places like North Korea, it's deceptive here in America. We do this with our wives and kids and husbands and fathers and mothers and friends and all that kind of stuff. And we say we love, but in reality we're masking our own self-love in marching in that guise. Okay, so if this is the highest ethic, then do we need this in order to make the decision?
Yes.
Do you need God in order to love somebody else?
Because, I mean, you need God. You need a definition for love.
Well, unfortunately, that cuts this discussion a lot shorter than I thought it was going to be. But that's exactly right. If you don't...
Because selfless and benevolent, that, like, who defines love?
love as selfless and benevolent.
So almost nobody that I know of disagrees on selfless. Like if you present a scenario to somebody and say, is it selfless or selfish? Usually they can identify it. Or the conundrum comes in when there's benefit to both parties. Then you're like, well, I've done it some out of selfishness and some out of selflessness. But if it's a binary thing of this causes harm to you and good to them, is that selfless? They'll be like, obviously. Like it's almost a tautology. So this is the problem, benevolent. Who sets the good? And if you don't have a definition for good, then you can't tell the rapist guy that he's wrong. Because in his mind, he's right. He is the best for that girl that she's ever going to have, and he will act on it. And he is right to act on it if there is no objective ground for this one, because that's what he knows with the greatest degree of certainty of anything. If you haven't watched a stalker mind, my wife's a forensic psychologist, so she's had to crawl in some of these guys' heads, at least from a research perspective. That person absolutely thinks that they are so passionate about that they believe beyond the shadow of a doubt that this individual, that they are the best thing ever for this individual. In fact, they know it. They know it, and they cannot, they will argue with you till the cows come home that that's the case. How do you convince a person so convinced that that's the case? How do you convince them that they're so convinced that they're the best thing, that they're wrong? How do you do it? You have to have a grounds for this objective benevolence. So now insert moral argument here. We've done that before in class. This is where we'll have to part ways from people that don't think that God is the ground for objective good or that there is no objective good. But if you don't have a definition for benevolent, this fails. You have to go to what does God say? Now here's the interesting thing. In the parent-child model, what are we? We're the children, right? God's the parent, we're the children idea. You see where I'm going with this, right? We may think that stuff God does to us looks like hate. Ask your 3-year-old whether getting spanked means mommy loves him or daddy or mommy hates him. What's the kid going to say? Most of them are going to say mommy hates me or daddy hates me at that time. That's how they feel at any rate. So does God hate women? Does God hate men? Does God hate the Jewish nation when he lets them be taken over by the Assyrians and the Babylonians? Well, what does Proverbs say?
God doesn't have the ability to hate. If his nature is a completely benevolent and loving being, like a perfect, all-holy being, then there's no room for hate. That's a human weakness. That's
okay,
sin
so let's say that's definitional, but let's go on his record.
He's
bringing up that point.
Okay,
so if God can, is it hateful when God, what does Proverbs say about discipline?
Spirit of rod, your rod, my comfort.
Right.
I guess Psalms.
That's Psalms, but yeah. And Proverbs is spare the rod, spoil the child. And everybody tries to define it in a way that doesn't mean rod. You know, rod generically means discipline. But bottom line is it pretty clearly says spare the rod, spoil the child. The idea, and what does it say more, now not Proverbs, but what does the Bible say specifically about God and love and discipline?
That God's a little more abused.
True, but that's not discipline.
Discipline is also the loss.
Yeah, God disciplines those whom he loves. It's, you know, pretty straightforward. So the idea is, and why would you do that? Because is discipline selfless? It seems hard to make that case, but can discipline be benevolent? Well, if discipline can't be benevolent, then you're all terrible parents. Terrible, terrible parents for disciplining your kids at all. But the idea is you want good for them, and you know that all they're going to do is eat cookies 24/7. It's not going to work out for them in the long run.
I mean, even I think saying discipline is selfless is kind of easy. I mean, excluding something where, like, if you're doing it for the wrong reasons and you're hitting your kid because you got frustrated or something, if you're hitting them, you're not going to be enjoying it. It's going to be like, I hate that I have to do this to you, but I need to teach you the lesson, blah, blah, blah. Like, it's definitely selfless because you don't want to do it and it's good for them. So.
Okay, but it's good for them is the other part. Right. This is an important operator right here. One alone is not love. You have to have both.
Sometimes smacking a kid does feel good.
That's what I'm saying.
Like, right, and this is a good point that can't be forgotten, but the idea is, even if we're trying to say, is it done in love, you can both.
Yeah, but that wasn't my point. I know what you're getting to here with objective rule. We've got which guy.
Right, so let's, the bottom line is,
I'll buy it for now, but which guy?
Okay, so let's say, in this case, the guy that best fits the all the data that we have scientific evidence, all the argumentation that we have, all the philosophical arguments we have, etc. So see the previous 2 years of class for that justification. Mm-hmm.
That's the answer, to see the previous 2 years.
Do you want me to go through the justification of who, the, who God is in class?
No,
please
no, not today.
It's been done before.
I got them all in a copy.
To everybody's satisfaction, but yours.
Not going
to read it. Does, now here, what we really want to know is how does God see this? How does God see this? That's ultimately the question. And if you're asking, the reason we went through this, whatever it was, an hour worth of talking about this, is because if you don't see that this is these dictates are the only possible grounds for love and how it ought to work, then you will miss the point. You will miss the point. So I hope that you have been convinced that if God is loving and he loves us, then what he says will actually be the most loving thing. Now, that's great, because if you agree with that, then I can just be like, well, it says it clearly, women are subservient to men, so case closed, class next time is going to be back to these gentlemen presenting on whatever. But what do we want to do? Now we want to balance in our heads this acknowledgement that this is the moral ground and that the dictates of a loving God are going to be correct. They're going to be selfless and benevolent, and they're going to be best for women and men. How do we resolve that with what feels like ownership at some times? So we kind of got into the military thing a little bit too early, but the point I want to make about this and then back to us for discussion is the following. Captain Mason and Colonel James.
Wait, why can't we make the woman the colonel?
Because it doesn't work that way. It's going to have to work this way, just for this example. If she is a company commander in his battalion, and he gives her an order to do something, and she says, I'm not going to do that. You're an idiot. I'm going to do what I want to do. What's the colonel going to say to the captain? Captain, I appreciate your opinion. The time for giving opinions is over now. These are your orders. Execute them. And she's like, I'm not going to execute the order. What's he going to immediately do?
Shoot her.
No.
What?
At a minimum, what's probably going to happen is he's going to relieve her of command on the spot. You're fired. Okay, you're not the captain anymore. You're going to go hand out. Loss of confidence. You're going to hand out basketballs at MWR facility for a while, probably on your way to some sort of either non-judicial punishment or UCMJ disciplinary action for refusal to follow an order, depending on in what place that happens.
Somewhere in Kansas.
Who among us thinks that that's wrong?
Well, what was the order?
Wait. Doesn't matter. It's a lawful order. Doesn't matter.
It's a lawful order.
It's a lawful order.
Lawful order.
That's what matters. Okay. Do we turn around and be like, oh, that's horrible. Look. She's valued less than he is. Why isn't the captain's opinion important?
Had nothing to do with her rank or her sex.
Had everything to do with her rank. Had nothing to do with her sex.
I know. But still, regardless of her rank, she knows what, if the order comes down, you could skip 10 levels, you still have to abide by it because it has been determined and you must follow it in a logical order.
All right. And so this idea of good order and discipline and military authority is grounded in authority. Who made him captain over her?
Colonel over her.
Some guy.
Colonel over her, thank you. Somebody, and the Commandant of the Marine Corps, whoever it was, in Congress, the President.
This is not only
the system.
Someone
the system
love their peers.
Put this guy in authority over her. And when she reacts against him and says, I'm not going to do what you ordered me to do, I'm going to do what I want to do, and we fire her, none of us have a problem with that. Yet we have exactly the problem with that if these two, I'm going to switch captain. Now, y'all are married. When he says to her, I want you to do this, and she says, no, I'm not going to do it.
Yes.
Now we have a problem with that. When he says, well, then I'm going to fill in the blank, take away your, or I'll take you before the church, and the church is going to enact some sort of church discipline, which is significantly easier on the physical front than military discipline is. But church discipline is stuff like we warn you and then we throw you out of the communion of the fellowship of Christians, if that's the case, right? Now, why is this wrong? Is this okay? And this is not.
What?
Why is it okay for the captain? Why is it okay for the colonel to fire the captain? It's not okay for the husband to tell the wife what to do.
Because we accept the inequality in this relationship.
Why?
Because that is part of the system. That is the established military system.
Okay. Is this part of Christianity?
Now you're at the questions.
Or Judaism?
Right. I say no.
Wise, with a with wife sitting right next to you? Sir, points
that actually, has nothing to do.
I know. And those of you that don't, I make a joke at Scholar's expense. He would say exactly the same thing if she were not here. A yes, ma'am, and then yes, ma'am.
Well, there's two issues where I think the analogy works down. First of all, the military is a very large organization, so you need a clear power structure just for the sake of getting things done.
Special Forces team, captain, and seven other guys, and in his operations center, there's probably two guys in there with him. Same scenario. Three-man team in the ROC, reconnaissance operations center, whatever else. Everybody else is dispersed. He's given orders to these two people. Smaller than the average family size.
Okay. Well, that leads me to my second point, though. In a military structure, and I mean, I could be wrong on this, correct me, but you have the opportunity, I mean, to eventually advance. I mean, there's no limitation as long as you are, in the military, as long as you're working hard, doing your job. You can advance, and you have the potential, and a lot of times it just has to do with years served.
Absolutely, so, and you get in there, and you will all the way till you are Commandant of the Marine Corps, the most hallowed position of any man ever walked the face of the earth. And who gives you your orders?
But no one is saying...
Who gives you your orders if you're the Commandant, the President?
But, I mean,
you're always under authority.
But technically, theoretically, there's no one that's going to say, because you are a woman or because you have brown hair, you just can never be president of the United States. Now, there are certainly, a lot of barriers to becoming president, right. But
there's no real
physical thing that would prevent you from being president.
So, can a woman be an authority? We're saying this in a family scenario. Can a woman be an authority over a nation?
Yes.
Gentlemen, what's her name?
Golda Meir.
What about in the Bible? Deborah. Right? Judge the whole nation of Israel. Okay. So, yeah, but your point, now I'm dodging your point, which is in the family. There is no family in which...
I guess what I'm saying is, you are, first of all, it's a small organization, and I don't understand why, at least at the parent level of the power structure, you can't be equal. And because there's only...
What do you mean by equal?
I mean, why you can't have the same approach? Why is it one person
having one side? Let's go back. Let's make it easy. Let's take all the moral out of it. Chef, we're making a dish. Chef, we're making a dish. Both you guys are in charge of making the dish. Okay. Do it. You going to disagree on flavor, cook time, how it ought to be browned?
You're looking for leadership,
etc. Somebody's got to make the final call. Disaster is defined as taking two 3-star Michelin chefs and putting them in the same kitchen and telling them that they're both in charge.
Point of orders.
Butcher knives are going to come out.
Point of order.
Yes.
I'm confused.
Yes.
I'm sorry, what's your name?
Julia.
If Skylar tells Julia, hey, go take the trash out, or some order, did you just tell him that if she doesn't do it, you can take him to the church?
We'll talk about that after this time. It's not like I've never seen that happen ever.
But it could happen.
It could happen in the same way that if the colonel tells the captain to take the trash out.
The colonel and the captain. I'm talking about a husband and wife.
I can't imagine that has ever happened in the history, and that any set of elders wouldn't be like, dismiss the wife for a second. Come here, buddy.
Thank you. But you just said it could happen.
Yeah,
I don't think they find
Skylar.
I feel like it's somewhat controversial.
Say it again.
But the two things that we're really all avoiding saying are submission and male headship.
Yes.
Those are the elephants in there, right?
Well, not anymore. We'll put the elephants up there.
All right. So submission, the Greek word is hupotasso. And hupotasso has both a military and a non-military interpretation.
Okay.
The military interpretation...
What was the other word? I've forgotten.
Hupotasso?
No.
The
male
relationship.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
So, submission has both a military and non-military definition. The one that was chosen, and I would argue in an unwarranted capacity, was the military definition. The non-military definition means to voluntarily choose to be agreeable, to be cooperative, which I don't really have a problem with. in our relationship. Sorry, Brian. The other one, male headship, is the word, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but kephale.
Not a Greek scholar, so I don't think you're working.
And this one, I feel like, is a much more debatable point, but it has alternative definitions, not only head, but also source or origin,
okay,
which are very different.
Let me take that point and skip for a second past these two terms and just take them as a granted for argument's sake right here. Let's pretend that this is the way that it works. Let's say that we've established that this said this. And if you are going to say, I'm going to believe that this has this for me. And remember, this is the justification. If God is benevolent and selfless and wants me to be happy, then for me, and this is the if, you don't have to buy into this now, I'm just tracing the argument chain for you. Then if I'm a woman, this and this will make me most happy. That doesn't make people too, right? So I'm saying, if you stipulate that, let's just say you take that as an if, let me explain what this looks like correctly. Because how many times have people in the military been under the command of somebody who's a complete knucklehead? Right, so that doesn't make you happy. So even though it's not male headship, some knucklehead headship makes everybody unhappy. Whether it's a woman in charge, whether it's a man in charge, whether it's a goat in charge. People are not happy when the person in charge is a knucklehead.
That only happens in the Marines, by the way.
Right. we'll get to your reference. The idea is, there are a couple of things in the military that are good truisms that everybody ought to consider. Stuff like this. Never give an order that won't be followed. All right, because you're just undermining your own authority. A better one is this. If you ever have to say to one of your troops, do this and that's an order, you have failed. Now, to really throw fuel on the fire here, I'm going to quote a Nazi general who actually had something good to say about leadership. This was Rommel, and you can say what you want about Rommel, but the bottom line is he ended up fighting for the Third Reich, so I think he did the wrong thing. But he said, I'll condense it down, but he basically said this: if you are not inspiring your troops to do things by your own personal example, you're doing it wrong. And anybody that barks out harsh orders, basically, it's a character flaw. Your orders come from a devotion to your troops that exceeds your devotion to yourself. This is Rommel's take on leadership, and it's as many generals take on leadership.
That's a logical melody.
And so, right, but the idea is this: if you're doing if a guy's doing this properly, the lady will be happy to follow. Just the same way, then imagine this. Let's say God didn't say this guy's in charge because of gender. Y chromosome, you're captain. X chromosomes, you're lieutenants. That's how it works. All right, the kids are all are privates and lance corporals. Mostly lance corporals. So, what if they flipped? What if God flipped it and said she's in charge and you're not? If you want to know how healthy your marriage is, press the reverse button on who God says is in charge, and how well does it work? Okay, so if there's a will problem there, now here's the interesting thing: if this is actually designed by God in such a way that men were supposed to kind of be natural leaders, then what you actually might see happen if you did that was she would turn around and delegate a lot of stuff back. So I've actually done this in my marriage, sort of. I went back to the wife, because we agreed kind of on this stuff, but I've never once told her. I've never issued an order to my wife, ever, for personal health reasons and others. I delegate all kinds of stuff to her. You're in charge of decorating the house. Why? I have absolutely no capacity for decoration, and if I did so, it would be horrific. So but hear me out. This is the interesting thing. When she turns around and says, carry this chair from here to there, go out and get this fabric and put it on that, what do I say?
Yes, dude.
Yes, ma'am. Because it's on my own authority that I've delegated to her, and to disobey her once I've delegated the authority to her is to disobey me.
So you make
and by extension, ultimately, to disobey God, right? So my wife's dictates on what color the fabric are the word of heaven, sort of, in my mind. From an authority chain, that's actually the case. From an authority chain, that's correct. Now, if we take that, and we'll get up, I know I'm long-winded here, but this is kind of the final thing. If you turn around and delegate properly, there are natural roles. There are natural roles. Let's take gender out of it. My first infantry platoon, second platoon command, first platoon command, first platoon sergeant, first squad leader, my first squad leader had a master's degree. I had a master's degree. Okay, education wasn't the difference between an officer and an enlisted troop in this case.
Your squad leader had a master's degree?
He literally showed up at the Marine recruiting station and was like, I want to run through the woods and shoot guns at people. And they're like, they look at his background like, you can do all this stuff. I want to run through the woods. They're like, your infantry contract. squad leader has, why is a squad leader subservient to me? What was the actual difference? I mean, why am I a better person to be the lieutenant than he is to be the sergeant?
It's roles.
It's roles, but I mean, is there anything behind it? Is there anything further behind it?
Perhaps it's skill.
It's
experience.
It ought to be, and this is, I'm fond of saying this, and I've watched this happen in combat. Rank disappears in combat. And what happens is, when the bullets start flying, to some degree, not completely, but to some degree, when the bullets start coming in, who do the troops look to?
Sergeant. The competent person.
The competent person. Sometimes it's the sergeant, and they ignore the lieutenant. When it's a lieutenant who has shown his chops to his troops, and in my opinion, one of the key things to training in the military is demonstrating to your troops that you're actually the best person to be in charge of them when it comes to this particular point. If your training doesn't teach them that, then don't expect them to act like that when war happens. But if it has happened, they will charge machine gun nests for you. The difference is they know that you are the best person to be in charge because your grasp of directing three squads in a tactical way exceeds your squad leader's capability to do so.
Yeah,
but if you die, then somebody else is going to be able to do it too. So here's the idea. If that's the case in the military, with kind of randomly, I mean, it's guys and guys, it's bachelor's degrees and master's degrees, and inversely, why can't God have designed it this way? Now, we've all agreed that there are these kinds of differences at a minimum between men and women. Do you think that those are to the point? Do you think that God designed the woman's mind differently from the man's mind for no reason? That doesn't even make sense, does it? Hang on a second. That doesn't make sense. And the idea is, if he did this, then this is probably rooted in this. The reason that we don't see this, and now I'll get on my high horse for the last 60 seconds and we'll go to comment. The reason that we don't see that anymore is, gentlemen, this is your fault. Guys, this is your fault. 100%. We have failed to be good men, good leaders, good husbands, good fathers, good teachers, good mentors, good elders, good presidents, good commanders. Had we done our job and done that so well, the women would have followed right behind us, just like the sergeant does. Falls right behind me. Had no problem falling behind me because he knew I had his best interest at heart, and he knew I was the most confident guy to lead that lieutenant. The ladies will do exactly the same thing. Now, what did I do when I was a platoon commander? Did I turn around and be like, well, I can do everything better than everybody here? Absolutely not. That guy's a better sniper than I am. That guy's 10 times the guy on the radio than I am. This guy right here is a better logistician than I am. So what do I naturally do when it's time to do logistics or sniping or communication? Hey, Sergeant Jones, can you get the radio up for me? Not give me the radio. I need to use it. Right? We automatically go to the expertise. We automatically go to the purpose and the roles. And at the minimum, if you want to have babies, you better have a wife. Okay, so that's a physical, obvious thing. But let me tell you what I've watched. This right here, when I let my wife be in charge of how babies are raised, I have gone almost completely hands-off to her. And that kid is better, I'm going to brag on my own kid right now. I'm completely stoked with the way that's turned out. Because she was built to do that.
Still
she's
always.
Better at it than I am. She's better at it than I am.
So I just want to make sure I understand. Are you talking about that in the context of marital relationship and beyond that context of society?
I'm trying to stick to the family unit.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
Because
I'm trying to make
it down beyond that.
Yeah, and I think
that's like
you take a lot of time. And if they're correlated, if it was because this is a family, therefore this is society, no Golda, no Deborah. But
and I think that's the rub. When people hear women and a subset of men hear this explanation, it sounds a lot like, well, men should run the family. Ipso facto, men should run everything.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like. So if you're not saying that, I think you have to be very careful to explicitly not say that.
Somebody, and look at your ledger right now, look at Proverbs 30, what's the last chapter of Proverbs? 31. Look at the Proverbs 31 moment, and tell me who's in charge of the house. Yes, ma'am. Sorry, I'm just kidding.
So I feel like when we look at words of submission and male headship, I can look at that and say, okay, I see that in my marriage. But I think more importantly, I see responsibilities and respect of those responsibilities. And that's a totally different way. So people who hate on the way that, you know, the Judeo-Christian view of these responsibilities will use submission, male headship, but in reality, like you were saying, my husband does not want my responsibilities, and my responsibilities absolutely make that house go. He knows that. And I, like, and same thing, I don't want his responsibilities at all. So it's one of those things that you take away the demand of it, and it's still the preference in many ways. But you're using the chef as an example, and that's perfect, because you can have a piece of food. If you have fish to cook, you can get it cooked. But how are you going to get it cooked better, seasoned well, and actually appetizing? It's going to take the two expertise. So I feel like we're going at this at like this negative, you know, in reality, it's responsibility, respect those responsibilities, and yes, we are created completely differently for a good reason.
And the only reason I am is because I'm trying to take it from our cultural point of view, not from the point of view that I'm trying to justify. So for anybody that hasn't gotten this, doesn't understand this about me, I believe in male headship. I believe that in a marriage, a woman should be submissive to a guy. That is logically posterior to the guy being a godly man and doing the right thing. Now, what do we do when you, you know, longer discussion for a different day, what do you do when you've got an ungodly man and a godly wife? Now what do you do? All right, the Bible does actually deal with that, but that, I don't want to get to that discussion because we're still working on the basics here. Steve, I've been skipping you for a while,
then
Dennis, and then
Gary. I appreciate all this discussion, and I appreciate you know, the leadership and the responsibilities and roles. And when I think of this time, you know, we're talking about slavery. And so, in the Bible, it says that we are slaves to sin.
So Steve hits on the point that is, I think, very fundamental, and I've covered in other classes before, and so I'll just make the point here, and then we'll go to Guy's comment, is this. Whether you agree with it or not, whether you realize it or not, you're a slave to something. So choose what you want to be a slave to. I can be a slave to the world, I can be a slave to my job, I can be a slave to an idea, I can be a slave to a culture, I can be a slave to an institution, I can be a slave to my own education, I can be a slave to my own appetite and expectations, I can be a slave to the devil, I can be a slave to my wife. Or I can be a slave to the one person that if anybody's got it right, is this one. I'm going to choose to be a slave to him. Guy and then.
Yeah, I'm kind of curious about the opinion of the ladies in the class here. God set up this system called marriage where gender is the final arbiter of decision-making. And are women okay with submitting to their husband, deferring, you know, decision-making on whatever the topic might be to the husband, if the husband's attitude is that he continually wants to lay down his life for the wife? Because that's how marriage is structured. Women submit to the husband, but the husband, his responsibility is to lay down his life for the wife as Christ laid down his life for the church.
Not true. Read the verse
again.
Okay.
Maybe so, it's a little off.
Is to love her like Christ loved the church, which means to the point that you would lay down your life. But that is not the sole qualifier, because even our stalker might lay down his life for a girl, but he's still going to treat her pretty badly.
Right. I'm just curious if the ladies in the class are okay with deferring decision-making in that type of a scenario where the guy's attitude is that he loves you so much that he wants your absolute best.
Maybe. Because instead of setting the bar that high.
No, that's the idea. That's the idea.
We would actually massively if that changed.
By show of hands, maybe the opposite way. Ladies, be strong. Who among you, if the guy really was the perfect guy, Prince Charming, whatever else, if he was Prince Charming and truly loved you, would object to doing this?
Can't we make decisions together? I mean, we're saying the man will make this decision. Can't we work together?
Yeah, but the difference, so, yeah, you're both in charge of the kitchen, but someone's a head chef and someone's a sous chef, and the lady's a sous chef. Okay, so here's the question. Ladies, is there any, raise your hand if you would not be willing to do this. I'm not going to pick on you, I just want to see if I...
Definitions matter.
Okay.
I do not believe that the definition of Hupitasso as military subservient to an absolute ruler is accurate. The voluntary attitude of giving in, totally can get behind it.
And I think that's what he means, a voluntary attitude.
I mean, so, if it's that, sure.
Or do you agree or differ?
Agree with her?
Yeah, or do you have something, if you wanted to add something.
Or would not submit to a perfect Prince Charming.
You would not.
I would not.
Okay, and why?
Because she's got a brain.
Well, let's say there is no. Well, I mean, if she is a perfect Prince Charming, there is, you know, am I the world's best, was I the world's best captain? No. I mean, I know that. Would I take the orders of the world's, let's say, do it in the military way, would I take the orders of the world's best captain? Yeah, if I knew he was the world's best captain, I'd be a fool not to. But tell me, I'm not saying that like a real jerk. I'm going to ask for you to differ with that.
I think because... I like to be able to have some control over my decisions, even if they fail.
Okay.
I like to know that everything isn't predetermined for me.
So let me ask the hard question then. Forget the guy.
Okay.
What about God?
I mean, that I feel like I submit because essentially, he is more powerful than I am, and he is more intelligent than I am, but I don't feel like I could say that of another human being.
Okay, fair enough. But is it only power and intellect? Power and intellect plus love, right?
Yes.
Right. Okay, all right. I don't actually know that I disagree with that, but the difference is, if the one with the power and the intellect and the love told you to do it this way, and you're like, but this guy's weak sauce. And he says, I want you to do it that way anyway. I've got a reason for it. Now do you disagree with the God? The if there is that if God has said this is the way.
Right.
And that
if
she's
God
parsing
has said this is the way.
Right.
Then I guess I would, if I interpreted it that way, I guess I would follow it, sort of begrudgingly.
Right. And I, you know, it's hard not to follow things. Like, Elijah did not begrudgingly...
Non-begrudgingly.
He wasn't skipping through Israel and being like, it's fine, the king's a complete knucklehead.
There are a lot of things God says in the Bible that I just wish he hadn't said.
Okay.
And I just wish he hadn't said. But if you pick and choose, like, life would be much easier if homosexuality were okay. I think, you know, just for all of us in general, we wouldn't be hated on so much if we could just say, hey, it's cool. There were just a lot of things I wish he'd left out, but if I start picking and choosing in the Bible what I'm going to follow and what I'm not, then the whole...
You're undercutting your own point that God is more intelligent.
Exactly.
Than you are,
right? So I would feel like I have to follow what I believe God has said, even though I don't know what's
going on. This is the essence of trust, and this is why we do obey God. What we say is, and how many people haven't prayed this, Christians? Lord, I don't know what you're doing in this situation. I would ask that you do X, but not as I will, but you. Who's the master on the Christian side of this? Right. I'm gonna get flogged and crucified. I don't want to do that. If there's another possible way, let's do it. But I will submit to that. And what happens at the end? You know, at least in the Christian view, not only does he fulfill all of Messiah's promises, he is now... Christians recognize
it. Close to being Kabbalistic, because we're trying to filter our way through pitfalls and everything else.
No. This is not Kabbalistic. I have taken this right here, and I've gone straight to the greatest ethics. We've gone to what these two definitions are and derived. This is the ontic foundation for this. And if this says do this, this is a direct logical chain.
I was paying attention, but at some point, did we make the assumption or conclude that men are morally valued?
Right. I think we didn't answer the question. I think what everybody in the room would say is this. Men and women are equal. What do we mean equal? Equal in value. Equal in value to who? God. What do they have different?
Roles.
So that's the real idea. Equal in value, different in role. And my point of the colonel and the captain is these are equal in value in the military. Or it's captain. Sometimes captain is in charge of another captain. These captains are equal in rank and value, but this one's been told he's in charge, and that one has been told that he's not.
I think everybody's good with that, equal in value, different in role, until one of those roles is being the boss of the other person. Then it starts to get... Then that's where the rub is.
No, we and only have a problem in that.
Parsed,
right.
I get that. But when you take a step back,
that's right.
That's where the friction is.
That's right. But my point is that we're inconsistent when we do that. We say that in a marriage, but we don't say it in the military. We say that in a marriage, but we don't say it in the kitchen. We say that in a marriage, but we don't say it at work.
Right. Because a marriage is a unique relationship. I think that is where your analogy breaks down across the board.
And then that's what we ought to discuss.
Right.
Had my hand up so long, I got a crick in my shoulder. I was going to ask, in your marriage,
right.
What is this headship stuff? Don't talk. I'm going to have you.
This is a point of disagreement because I.
So what is it, first of all? I don't understand what this headship is talking about.
It is not practiced. In my marriage.
What is it?
I don't know that I'm the best person to give you a definition when I do not ascribe to it personally.
What is headship according to you?
There's an H.
No, sorry.
Yeah, but intergreed.
What is this theory of headship?
I mean, I feel like in marriage where there's a headship, to me that means, you know, he's making the ultimate final decision on things. And whether they pertain to us as a couple or, you know, to my job. Like, I don't want him making decisions for me about my job or, you know, whether I, you know, do this thing or do that thing, you know. I want that to be, like, I consult him on it. But, like, ultimately, you know, it's my decision. And then when there's other things, you know, having to do with the two of us, like, I want it to be equal. I want us to both have our input. And if we can't agree, you know, flip a coin or, you know, Google what's the best.
I
don't want it to be, you know, headship is when we disagree, well, the final say ultimately goes to him. I think that there's a better way to settle it than just saying, when we disagree, he has the final
set. Trial by combat?
I'm sorry.
What's the better way to say it?
One more question.
Well, give me an example. So, I mean, if there's a better way, we've identified at least one way, what is the better way?
I have two more questions.
You have a standby.
You're not the colonel.
Cathedra maya, regula maya.
Sometimes it's through prayer, and one of us ultimately will come to the understanding that decision A is better and, you know, just taking time to settle it. Sometimes,
what if the one of us is you and he comes to the decision the belief that that's not the case?
What could possibly be an error?
But you asked a question. What is the definition?
Dennis, can I answer your question?
Yes.
Can I? Wait a minute. I'm done.
I was recognizing your hand for one question, not four, because I got a couple of questions. Yes, ma'am. Go ahead. I'm going to you.
Go ahead. I was just going to find him, like, I think, too, like, when he didn't know what to believe, so like, my dad handed me over to him, it was like, I know my dad loves me more than I can say, so he's like, I'm entrusting you to him. So, in other words, like, if it came down to, like, me deciding, like, okay, do I want to go back to work, like, ultimately, even if it was if I was against the choice and Peter said, no, I really don't think you should work, I know that he loves me. Like, I know that he also took a vow before Christ, like, he loves me just like Christ loves the church. So it's interesting how that works out, that I would have no, it would be difficult, but in the end, like, when you talk about headship like that, I look to him and he's going to have to answer for it.
This brings up a very important point.
My point's the same. It's that the headship, it's the responsibility of making this marriage successful. It falls on my husband, it doesn't, and he's ultimately the one responsible. That's what that means to me. And that means decisions like what she brought.
And I feel loved by that.
So a couple of points here, and then we're basically out of time.
And plus, I'm married to Peter, so most of the times what he recommends.
If the important point of all this is, if God said this, when your husband fails, ladies, and we will frequently, when they fail, you are underwritten. There is an insurance underwriter that says, do what I say, and it will work out for you. All things, bad husbands, bad family decisions, bad fill in the blank, all things work together for good for those who love God and those who are called according to his purpose. If this is his purpose for you, and you are fulfilling that purpose, then it will work out in your favor. Now, what are decisions that you, and I'm going to look at you, are next on the dock on this one. We'll pick on her because she's actually made in my opinion, good choice. When she selected a husband, when she said yes to a proposal, the rest of her life, the question is this. Is he good enough? Do I love him enough? Is he trustworthy enough that when the chips are down and he's going to make a call differently than what I want, that I trust him? And that I'm willing to enter into this relationship because this person said so, and I believe in them first, him second, them first, him 50th. Am I willing to do that? Ladies, don't make that choice wrong. Because your life will be a lot harder if you submit as a Christian to somebody, or a Jew, to somebody that's a bad husband and father. Your life is going to be tough. So don't enter into a marriage lightly, if I can give you advice. Right? So, yes, sir, your last point, and this will be our last one.
Scott's saying there's still time.
I think you made an excellent choice.
What's your name?
Mandy.
If I kill him and my wife, will you marry me?
I know what's best.
Remember what I said about selecting carefully. Alright, so obviously we'll pair this class. We'll go continue the discussion. I gotta check and see if this room is still open over here for those that are willing to or want to. But as you can see, this is a difficult topic. Very difficult topic, right? There's no doubt about it. I haven't actually got into any of the practicalities as to why this might work out. But I will tell you that there are many. And modern scientific research actually demonstrates it, even though they will try everything that they can to say, to try and figure out a way to adapt that differently. But the bottom line is, this actually works when done properly, and it works in the mean better than the opposite does. Unfortunately, that's the truth. Here's what I would say to you, ladies. And if I had a daughter, I've got two sons, unfortunately, so this point doesn't ring as true. You should embrace this, because when they do this, you got the better end of the deal. Wives, submit to your husbands. All right, what a pain, especially when the guy's being a knucklehead. Husbands, love your wives. That's the coming that he's helped. You actually have the freedom to love or not love. The man doesn't.
Wait.
He has been commanded to treat you like Christ treated the church.
So
it is an order. If he fails to love you, God judges him for that. He actually hasn't given you the same order in that same way. So keep that in mind. You kind of got the better end of the deal. Better to be the lady on the pedestal than a knight in bloody armor.
So Hillary Clinton wants to run for president, and Bill says, no, that's not a good idea. Yes. She's got to back out.
No.
So I agree.
Neither one of them should have been running for
president. I agree with you. I always thought loving is harder than obeying. So, but why not give more difficult job to one gender?
The idea should be this, is if that's the case. So our men, I'm going to argue this two ways, and I'm out of time. Toughness can be defined a few ways. Men are acknowledgedly tougher in some ways, right? Who wins the Iron Man? It's always a guy. Who, you know, special ops teams are built to guys, marine infantry built to guys, that kind of stuff. That's one kind of tough.
Yeah,
there are, who gives birth, although having had a kidney stone and having heard women say that both are the same, I can tell you this, I went down like a pump when I got a kidney stone. So I do think that there are kinds of toughness, and this is the difference. You're built for different tough. Ladies are tough in the place where their roles require toughness. Men are tough in the place where their roles require toughness. When you blend those things, that's when failure occurs. Don't try to be tough where you're weak. Your wife is tougher at certain things than you will be. Your husband is tougher at certain things than you will be. Let him be tough where God built him to be tough. That's what I would say. And sometimes God, it's not, you know, again, we're doing the normal, all guys are like this, all girls are like this. God builds pairs out of non-standard couples. So that happens sometimes too, so keep that in mind. But it's not wrong for a woman to be the one who actually picked up the shotgun and defended her family in her house or something like that. You know, you're not like, oh, that wasn't your role. You should have waited for me to know. So, and I use that as an example. I bought my wife a pistol when she was going up to a high crime area to work, and I found out you can't carry because the Democratic Republic of Maryland. But I realized after the fact that arming her was a terrible idea because she's so sweet. She would not make the decision to pull the trigger until after the guy had attacked her, gotten her gun, and shot her with it. Until today.
Don't be so sure.
Now with the two boys at home,
oh,
she's going to shoot first and ask questions later. So, we're out of time. Let's break the class down, and we'll move to this next one. But thank you very much.